Hey everybody, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim. And in the background, we're listening to folks getting settled in for our second annual I Live Here storytelling event.
Yeah, we first had one of these a little over a year ago. Mm-hmm. It was at the Herb Arts space in Old North in St. Louis. And we had such a great time that we decided we were going to do it again.
All right, so here's the deal for this year. We got so many great stories, and we're going to give you two episodes full of those stories.
So
this episode you're listening to right now, we're going to listen to the first half of that show, and then the next episode, we'll give you the second half of that show.
Yeah, and just so you guys know, this really is Tim and I's chance to kind of step way, way, way back and literally hand over the mics to the community. So you won't hear as much of us in these next two episodes. We hope that's okay. You guys are probably tired of listening.
Yeah, it's like we talk so much.
God. Anyway, so here you go.
Yeah. All right, so coming up, it's story time.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. So from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Show for people somewhere.
Somewhere. I don't know where you're at.
Somewhere on the woke spectrum.
All right, it is time now to get into some great storytelling from St. Louis. And our first story comes from what I think is safe to say one of our very, very favorite people we have ever had on We Live Here.
Yeah, she is super cool. And she's been on the podcast a few times, but twice in this last season just alone. So we think you guys will enjoy her.
So without any further ado, this story comes from Amy Hunter.
So the story that I'm going to tell is of my parents, actually. Prior to the Obamas and our display of watching them and their black love and their black magic moments, I had Andrew and Cheryl Johnson. My mom was an ex-nun that came out of the convent after questioning too many times, deciding that lesbianism wasn't what she was down for, and really dedicating her whole life to God without sex was probably not going to make her life full. So she came out of the convent, and lo and behold, while attending college, met my dad, who was in graduate school, who was the son of a Baptist preacher. We had so much fun in my family growing up that it's sometimes hard to explain to people what water fights inside and outside of your house might look like. But most importantly, I watched them sing songs together. I didn't know people danced in clubs until I got to college because our family room turned into like a party every Friday and Saturday. And so black love was something that I saw a lot of. Now, I had two sets of grandparents, my dad's parents, who showed me what commitment looks like. So they had separate bedrooms, and they were married for over 50 years. And I remember thinking as a kid, this is so great. Like, you could get married and have your own bedroom? Like, I'm totally doing it this way. And then I met my mother's parents, who were very in love, more like my parents in love. So the sing-song love, the smile at each other as they come through the door kind of love. And as I talked to my grandmother, I called her Nana, I said, my other grandparents have their own bedrooms, but you guys have to share. And she assured me sharing was better when you're married. And so I got to see what commitment looks like, but also what love looks like. My mother went to work when I was in grade school with a understanding from my father that she still wanted dinner on the table at 6 p.m. every day. He still wanted dinner, and he wanted his house to stay clean as if she was still a stay-at-home mom. And when I was in fifth grade, my dad did what we call the white glove test, which means that he literally went around my house with his finger, swiping counters, looking at dust. My mother left him 2 days after that. And she left us with him. And I remember saying, why wouldn't you take us with you? Every movie I'd ever seen, the mom leaves with the kids. And she eloquently said, he's a bad husband. He's not a bad dad. I'm not sure exactly how long she was actually gone. It felt like a lifetime because I was 10 years old. What I could tell you was, for every single day that she was gone, he got home from work. He could cook absolutely nothing, so we ate breakfast for dinner for the entire time she was gone. And he put a record on. And the record that he put on was One in a Million. And so at 10 years old, me and my siblings all learned the songs to I Was a Lonely Man with Empty Arms to Fill. And he cried at that record player every day until she came home. She came home, I think, honestly, it was 2 or 3 weeks later. And their marriage was forever changed. It was transformed forever. For the rest of my life, my dad would be the person who did all of our laundry, who vacuumed, mopped, and refinished every floor in our home, who asked her if she ever needed anything prior to her needing something, who made sure that she got to sleep in late every weekend because she liked to sleep in late. And he became an even better dad and an even better husband than we could imagine. Unfortunately, at 50, my father came to the room where my mother and I were chatting, and he had a look on his face that caused my mother and I to begin to weep. We started to cry immediately. He asked me to take him downstairs and outside, and he looked up and down our street and throughout our house as if he was taking snapshots of his life. He rubbed my head gently and told me to get my mother that he was ready to go to the hospital. My mother, who rushed to get dressed, it was obvious that something was wrong, also had to get gas. It was a Sunday, so she had to get gas in the car. She pulled up to the gas station. She jumped out of the car to pump gas. And at that moment, she knew my father must be very sick, because in the 26 years that they had been married, she had never pumped her own gas. So she pumped the gas, they got to the hospital, and shortly thereafter, we understood that he had had an aneurysm. He remembered very sketchy things during this time, during this transition. He kind of remembered who she was. He didn't remember who I was. He remembered my brother and sister. It must be a middle child thing. But prior to, about 2 or 3 days before he died, he asked her if he had done a good job. And she assured him he had been a great husband. My mother lived for the next 13 years as a widow, never remarrying, really never dating. She had her first heart attack at 48. We say often that she died of a broken heart. She was just too young at that time to go so quickly behind him. So she had had her fifth heart attack. I called my siblings in. My sister and I were in the hospital. We had to make the decision to take her off life support. And then we waited. We decided that as much time my parents spent with music, we would turn the radio on for my mother. We thought she might enjoy listening to some music on her transition. As we turned the radio on, One in a Million played. What are the chances? We often asked my mother after each heart attack if she saw my dad. She said, "When I see your dad, I won't come back." When the music played, we were assured that not only was she at peace, but that she would soon be with him, once again, in love and in love forever. Thank you.
She was going to be good. Okay, so our next storyteller is an organizer, activist, creator, curator of dope shit, and she's also a St. Louis native. And I also want to say that we just added her to the lineup a few days ago because she was so gracious when we decided that we were going to give you guys even more storytelling. And she came through in a very short amount of time. So I want to bring up Chris Blackman.
All right. Cool. All right. Cool. How can I follow Amy?
Go on.
Peace, y'all. I'm happy to be here. So thinking about a story, I want to talk about, for me, the intersection of my spirituality and my sexuality is what I'm going to speak to. So quickly go back and move forward to the present time. So As Camille said, from St. Louis, always been a tomboy, sporty girl growing up. Went to college. Before I went to college, I was told don't get turned out, right, by friends. Went to college and got turned out. More like discovering the fact that I did love women. So my freshman year of college, I had my first experience, and then from that point on, came into my sexuality. Before that, grew up in church, Baptist church. That's where I was planted. During the time of discovering who I was as a woman and my sexuality, realizing that church was not for me. Like, that was not the institution that I needed to be in any longer, that I could not be my full, whole self in that space. So for years, I wondered about on some, like, you know, I have my relationship with God. I'm good. I don't have to be in church. Like, I will never find that space. Little did I know, about 5 years ago, I would actually enter into a church that totally flipped my mind into how I could be my whole self in a space. And I say that standing here as, you know, Black woman, queer, radical, and all of the work that I do, being able to have all of that and bring all of that to the table. And what I've discovered about myself is that never turning down or dimming any of those pieces. I feel like often sometimes we're forced to, sometimes intentionally or unintentionally, removing layers from ourselves when we go into different spaces, whether it's work, whether it's in different relationships that we're in, not being able to be our full whole self. What I discovered was the liberation that came with being able to be my full whole self in church. So at one point where when I was in church, I wasn't one that was necessarily in leadership in church, but what I found myself currently is being just that. So God calling me to lead within ministry, which is something that I never thought would happen again. So as I stand here, as I'm able to navigate in life, and again, becoming the woman that I have become to be, what I found is that in every space that I've gone in, being able to, especially thinking about Black church, for those that aren't totally familiar how Black church operates, Black church can be, I mean church period, but me speaking specifically to Black church, how Black church is one of the most oppressive spaces, one of the most oppressive institutions for folks to be in, and that's real. From sexuality to radicalism, all of those different things. So be able to be into a space where I could be that, totally countered that narrative of what church can be. What I found is that I needed community to grow within my spirituality. So having this isolated place of being with religion and spirituality is not what I needed for myself. What I did need was a community. So being able to be in that community and then finding myself being able to lead in that space was something that has really literally changed my life. So having that peace and also being one that works in the community and does activism work, what I have also found is the oppression that comes within that of my sexuality. So being a woman leading in spaces, being a queer woman leading in many spaces, I have also found to be oppressive. But again, what I have found myself doing is showing up as my full whole self. At this point, I feel like when you show up, like if you show up and you're bold and present in how you are true to yourself, can nobody do anything but respect that? You force people to respect who you are. So any space that I go in, this is me walking into the room. This is me speaking for those who may feel like they can't do that. I have friends my age and older that still don't know how to be themselves in their church, at work, even in their relationships, in their romantic relationships, not knowing how to be that. And I'm not saying I have it all figured out, but what I have figured out is that I will always be true to who I am in all of these spaces. The reason why I wanted to speak to my spirituality and God is because that is truly where I have got my help from, literally, in being able to do all the work that I do, to walk into all of these different spaces, and demand that I be seen, to demand that I be heard, and to demand that all those that look like me, and even those that don't, are also heard and seen as well. So I think that's it. Thank you.
All right, so we're going to take a quick, in podcast land, I guess you would call
it, intermission. Yeah, go get your popcorn, whatever you need to do.
Whatever you got to do. We're going to take a quick little intermission. When we come back, more storytelling from I Live Here in St. Louis. So when we first met to talk about who we want to ask to tell stories at our show, we thought it would be really, really cool to have a public official.
Yeah, because, you know, as journalists, we tend to talk to public officials when they're, like, in the news, or maybe they've done something, or we need a comment on something. We're not just saying, like, hey, let's just, like, talk stories.
Yeah, let's learn about you as a person. So we put together a list of people we were thinking, okay, we can reach out to because we've got connections with these folks and we can convince them to say yes. And there was one name that floated to the very, very top of
and,
the list.
Yeah, we didn't know if she was going to say yes, but we figured, like, why not? Let's just go for it.
We asked our political reporter here at the station, Jason Rosenbaum, who we've had on the show, like, a bunch. Would you be willing to reach out to this person and ask, you know, hey, would you think about doing this thing? This person then got back to him immediately and then got back to us immediately and said yes. And we were really, really thrilled that she did that. And she's got an amazing story to tell. Her name is Maria Chappelle Nadal. She's a Democratic state senator in Missouri.
I'll keep my mouth clean. So many of you know me by my public life, and you don't know about my personal life. But my personal life is what molded me, and it's really why I am the advocate that I am today. So, my mouth gets me in trouble. It wasn't always the case, but there's only one time in my life, even today, that I said something and it actually hurt my feelings. When I was a little girl, my mom figured out that I had a serious speech impediment. And I couldn't say things like tomorrow. I would say tomorrow, tomorrow. In first grade, I was taken out of my class every single week. I was in the special school district. I went to school in University City. And every week, I would leave out of Miss Larson's class, Miss Anna Louise Larson, and I would go to the resource room. And in the resource room, I would go through my double O's and my U's and my I's and all of those things so I could just speak. And in second grade, when I was in Miss Bonner's class, I was taken out of the classroom and I went to the resource room and I got help for my speech. I was a really shy kid. Most people don't know that I'm really shy. Like, try dating and telling that cute guy that you really, really like him, and you can't get the words out of your mouth. When you have a speech impediment, you have to worry about how your lips form, how your tongue moves. It's the logistics of your mouth that you can't get right. When I was young, I would literally, even now, but when I was young, I would look at people's lips to see how to form a word. I didn't want to speak. I was scared to speak. People made fun of me because of how I spoke. It was embarrassing. In third grade, I went to the resource room again every single week to get help. And in fourth grade, in fifth grade, sixth grade was special though. I gave the morning announcements. Now, how does a kid who doesn't know how to speak really well give the morning announcements every single day I wasn't known as Maria because I hated my first name. I was known as Nikki. So Nikki Chappelle Nadal gave the morning announcements. Every single day was part of my speech therapy. I had administrators and teachers who said, let's help her in this way. She's giving the morning announcements. So today in University City, there are people who vote for me because, one, I'm either the girl with all the last names or the girl who gave the morning announcements every single day in sixth grade, in seventh grade, and in eighth grade. I gave the morning announcements. So in eighth grade, my big achievement was to give the eighth grade speech. I had taken opera lessons. That was really important. Opera lessons, opera, helps you with your articulation. And it's also a way that you express yourself. So as I'm in middle school, as I'm in high school, the way that I figured out how to express myself is that I was going to sing. And I was going to dance. I remember dancing at the house all the time to music. And man, let's see. My mom, a single mother who worked two jobs, really sacrificed a lot to help me with my speech. And, you know, sometimes I didn't see her. And it was kind of lonely. And I remember just being that latchkey kid and being responsible for my own livelihood, making my own lunch. And it was just really hard. And I got to a point in time where my mom had some guilt as a single mom. And because she wasn't around, she was just trying to make sure that I had opera lessons, that I was able to go to Sylvan Learning Center, that I was able to continue in my therapy just speaking. My mom didn't have any restrictions, though. That's the problem today. She didn't have any restrictions. She didn't try to say, you can't say that, you can't say that. There was no filter because she just wanted me to speak. Because I didn't speak. I was scared to speak. I was really scared to speak. And so time went by, and I'm creative. I love art. I love music. One of the ways that my mom gifted me during the summers is we would go to New York, and I would go see a Broadway show. So we saw, like, Lay. We saw Tommy. But my favorite one was Phantom. So how many high school students are singing Phantom in their living room? I was. When I was in high school, there's this Billy Joel song. I was so proud that I could get it out of my mouth. Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn's got a winning team, Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bongo, Budapest, Alabama, Cruise, Chef, Princess Grace, something, Trouble in the Suez, or something like that. Like, my mouth was able to formulate all that. It came out, like, with not a lot of mistakes. So I went to college, you know. I was then known as Maria. I went from Nikki to Nicole to Maria. So at 19, I'm Maria. And I knew I loved politics. It was my life. And I was always inspired. My mom believed in tough love. Still today, she believes in tough love. And I was always inspired by the story of people who came from the bottom and raised themselves up and achieved something. That was my life. And I said I was going to go back home. I went to school in Georgia, and I said I was going to come back home. And I was going to work in public life. I didn't know how I was going to do that, but I just wanted to do that. And I ended up running for office. My favorite high school teacher, Mrs. Donna Rogers Beard. See, that was a mistake. Donna Rogers Beard, she gave me this book, and it was about a Puerto Rican girl who lived in New Jersey who didn't believe that she had a future, but she ended up having a future and doing miraculous things. And that was my encouragement to I could be anything that I wanted to. And on my steps where I live today, Donna Rogers Beard was standing there, and it was the end of the day of my first election. And I just look at her, and she looks at me, and I'm like, I can't believe I just did that. I wasn't supposed to win. I wasn't the person who was chosen. I'm not the person who is molded into a certain place or a certain way who's supposed to be the elected official. Like, how did that happen? And I just cried. And she cried on my porch. And I'm like, I can't believe I just did that. I can't believe I just did that. Oh my goodness. So I went to the legislature. And if anyone knows about the House of Representatives, you have 15 minutes to talk. One of the ways that I cheated my way out of making mistakes was to always be prepared. So I always study. Anyone who has a disability, you rely on something else to make you stronger. That's what I do. That's what I did, which is why Republicans hate me today. Because I'm always prepared, over-prepared, because I know that I'm going to mess up something if I just speak from the hip. So I study. So in any case, in the House of Representatives, you have your 15 minutes, and I was able to read that stuff. So I studied, I read my points, here you go. You didn't get into many debates, right? It was kind of easy, because there were other people like Margaret Donnelly who just knew all about Medicaid, or Barbara Fraser, who knew all about family values of people. So I just voted right. I was always prepared. I had my notes, had 15 minutes, and then it was over. It was all done, because I couldn't speak anymore. And then I ran for the Senate. Ooh, the rules are different. You can speak as long as you want. So I studied for my first filibuster. I studied for 6 weeks. 6 weeks. So I had these attorneys who would meet with me every single weekend, and the legislation we were talking about was workforce discrimination, and I just read all of these cases, and it was just so appalling, all the stuff that I saw. And I was prepared. I was nervous, but I was prepared. Like, how are you going to stand for 10 hours? I had every single case that I was studying, and it was so easy to do. And they were like, I can't believe that big girl just did that. So that's when you get to the negotiating point. And then Ferguson happened. I was always able to hide behind studying. So I studied, I was prepared, I could speak because I was prepared. But nothing called me like Ferguson. There weren't many elected officials, if any at all, who were present. And in the very early days, it was just really hard. And I'm like, oh my goodness, oh my god, what am I gonna do? What am I supposed to do? I just got tear gas for 3.5 hours in a street without any outlet. What am I doing? How do I respond? How do I communicate? Did this just really happen? Is this really what our community is about? Are people really, like, responding in this way and degrading human beings in this way and disregarding the feelings of young people this way? Really? I had to stand up. I had to speak unprepared. I had to speak unprepared, and all I knew were the feelings of mothers and grown men crying in my arms. I was called to be on TV, and I don't like being on TV. I don't like being on radio because I know that I'm going to make a mistake. To this day, I've listened to myself 5 times. 5. This day, no more, because I can't hear my mistakes. I don't want to hear my mistakes when I speak, because it makes me feel hurt. But I went through that. I was speaking for other people. It wasn't about me. It was about the young families who felt as though they had something taken away from them, and in many cases they did. It was about that mother who was crying. It was about that man who just got out of jail the day before Mike Brown got killed. It wasn't about me any longer. And the media kept coming and they kept asking me, what is going on in your community? And then I served as a translator. Who told me that I would be a translator? Who told me that I would be a teacher? Who told me that I would be a sister? Who told me that I would be a mother? Why did you put me in this place, God? I'm just supposed to vote right. I'm supposed to stand up for people who believe in freedom. I'm supposed to stand up for kids who want a quality education. That's what I stand for. I stand up for people who want to marry whoever they want to marry. That's who I am. But nobody said that I would be tear gassed for 3.5 hours. No one said that I would have my entire livelihood in question, but you just show up because nobody else showed up. No other elected officials showed up. It was Sunday, August 10th, and we were right there on the street, and there were people who were totally disrespecting the young folks, the youth, the underground rappers, the gang members. And then there was me in that circle, the communicator, the translator, the mother, the teacher, the sister. And so I kept speaking, never watching any interview ever. I just translated. This is how they felt. This is what's going on through their minds. This is what they want. This is what they are doing. This is what should be happening. This is what's been ignored by the legislature. And I started finding my identity through that experience. I was fortunate to never have to be in a situation like that, but it was necessary. You know, sometimes when you grow, it's hard and it's rough. It's brutal. It takes every single thing out of you. But it's necessary. So it was Ferguson, October, and I was feeling good. I just lost 80 pounds. I was feeling real good. I had this scarf on, a Ralph Lauren navy blue jacket, and I had my skinny jeans on. I felt good. So we were downtown. I took a picture with Percy Green, and the picture looks great. It's awesome. Like, girl was looking fine that day. And I knew that I had to go to the St. Louis Literary Festival because I was reading to kids Dr. Seuss. I happen to love Dr. Seuss, so when I go to classrooms, I always have a book list of what I will read to kids. It's always Dr. Seuss. So it may be Hooray for Different Doofer Day, or it may be Fox and Socks. By the way, Fox and Socks is the best book in the world, especially when you have a speech disability. It helps you to articulate. So as I'm having fun with these kids, I'm actually practicing. I'm giving them life, but I'm also exercising my mouth so that my words are formulated correctly. Most people don't know that. So I usually have this thing with kids, and I ask them to raise their hands, and I say, "Who's your favorite rapper?" And they'll say, "Oh, Nicki Minaj, Drake, Lil Wayne." And I say, "Did you know that Lil Wayne used to read Dr. Seuss?" And if you want to be like Dr. Seuss, you're going to have to read. Or if you want to be like Nicki Minaj or Drake or Lil Wayne, you're going to have to read Dr. Seuss. So on this day, Ferguson, October, I go from downtown, I go back to University City, And I'm walking down Del Mar, just feeling good. I'm feeling good, as Medea would say. Feeling good. I'm walking past Fitz's, and there are four Caucasian women. And they snub me. It's the first time that I had ever been snubbed. And there's a sound that goes along with the snub. It's there's a sound. Like, I never was snubbed before in my entire life. I never heard a sound that goes along with a snub. But these four women snubbed me. Two of them were supporters of mine. And I know only because of what I was saying in Ferguson did they snub me. Because I was the safe African-American before Ferguson happened. I was the acceptable African-American before Ferguson happened. I was the only African-American who would be showing up to the all-white female meetings in the neighborhood, and it was okay because I was accepted. You're the accepted black person, Maria. Until Ferguson. Until I became a translator of people who had been oppressed for such a long time and for decades, who were feeling the pain and the trauma of everything that had been happening to them for so long. I was their translator. I was their sister. I was their mother. And these women snubbed me because I stood up for these people who feel as though they had nothing and no love and no respect, nothing. And I accepted that snub. And I kept walking to the literary festival because I was about to read to children Dr. Seuss. And the lesson here for me was, I was that voiceless kid who didn't say anything, who was so scared and so shy. I was afraid to talk. I was afraid to express my feelings. And the reason why I kept going to that festival is because for the kids who I was reading to, I didn't want not one of them to have to go through or endure the same pain that I went through when I was a kid.
All right, so we are not done with the storytelling.
But we are done with this episode.
But before we officially roll credits, we want to make sure we give some very, very special thank yous. And we'll start with Phil Donato here at St. Louis Public Radio, who helped us with all the logistics for this event.
And also M.K. Stallings with Herb Arts, which is where we had the event. He helped us a ton, especially with some creative stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Greg Montanue, our sound engineer for the evening. He's also with St. Louis Public Radio, and he's the reason why it sounds so good.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Greg. We Live Here is produced by me, Camille Stanley.
And me, Tim Lloyd. Shula Newman is the executive editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.